Major Tice, Real Two.
I also made an awful lot of friends. Not forgetting, you must remember that I was now not 22. I made a lot of friends of the planters, the Forestry Commission people. And the various eccentrics that lived in a place like Blair. And I literally sat at their feet and listened to them. Because they could teach me so much about the jungle, the folklore. I remember one, I took some leave and went off with a man called Anker Rensi. Now Anker Rensi was a Dane who was known throughout Malaya as one of the experts of the jungle and of the different dialects spoken. And he took me virtually on a trip right across Malaya using the small streams, unknown rivers. And that taught me an awful lot about the jungle and the people in it, and how they lived in it.
Can you give some specific instances of the type of things that you learned which helped you?
Well, yes, I'll tell you one of the things. The fact that we used to... We were lucky. I mean, we had... We went up the rivers in prows, which is the... rowing boats. So we were lucky. We weren't rowing our own, rowing ourselves. But on occasion you had to take the boat out, carry it around a rapid, put it down further upstream or downstream, wherever you were going. But I remember vividly that when we stopped for the night, and we always stopped at some village that Anker knew the headman, and there was a great feast laid out for us. The first thing you did was to go down to the river and get the leeches off you. And you virtually scraped them off you. The great way of getting a leech off you is either by the bag of salt. On the end of the bamboo you put a little bag of salt so you touch them and they did fall off, or by cigarette. But they were pretty nasty things. But in the end, like everything, you got used to them. But when the troops were first got into the jungle, they were during the war, they were a pretty nasty form of irritation, should we say.
What was the morale of the brigade whilst you were setting up these defenses?
Well, the morale of the brigade was extremely good. We had a wonderful brigade commander, a gentleman called Billy Key, who... I think I'm right in saying... I may be wrong, but I have said it in my book. He had a DSO, I'm sure. I think he had an MC as well, from either Frontier War or the First World War. He was a great leader of men. He led from the front, Billy Key. I'll give you an example. In Malaya, in Kota Baru, there were two clubs. The Malay Club, which was for all the Malayan officials, police sergeants, customs sergeants, that ilk of person. And then there was the what I always called, I don't know, I forget what it was called, the Tuans Club, which was for white people only. Now, don't forget, we had a lot of Indian Army officers in the brigade by now. These officers had been trained in Dehradun, which was the akin to Sandhurst, and were very intelligent men and very well connected men in India. But the powers that be, or the white powers that be, civilian powers that be in Cote d'Ivoire, said no Indian Army officers in the Tuans Club. Billy Key heard about this and said, if my officers are not good enough for you, neither am I. And he resigned, which caused quite a lot of consternation. And in actual fact, the club was opened in the end to the Indian Army officers. But I never used that white club. I used to go down and use the Malay club. I found it far more interesting and far more pleasant. I still am, and this is my bolshiness coming out in me still, I still am very bitter at the way that a lot of the civil servants treated the whole setup prior to the actual start of the war.
Did the Indian officers actually join the Tuan Club?
No, I don't think I know anyone who did. You better ask Ismail Khan on that one, but I don't think so. Well, I know he didn't, because we used to go down together to the Malay Club. I used to run a football side there of the Brigade Signals and the Brigade Clerks. This was mainly, well, it was all predominantly white soldiers. And we used to play the customs and the police, the Malay customs and the Malay police, and then all go off and have a party at the Malay Club. And this was a good way of getting to know the natives.
Now, you were saying that morale was high, but was this high in spite of all the deficiencies you could see in the preparations?
I think morale was high because it had to be high. You see, it was a very awkward place to defend. Kelantan was joined to what was it, Pera? The state lower down, by one railway, that's all. And if the bridges had been blown, we would have had a hell of a job getting out, and this was a predominant factor in the plans for the defence of Kelantan. It rarely was an awful hodgepodge, because we were virtually sent up there originally to defend the beaches and defend the airfield at Cote d'Ivoire. Now, the Cote d'Ivoire airfield was, it couldn't have been strategically put in a worse place. It was literally, as the crow flies, about 4 miles from the beaches where we expected the Japanese to land. So you can hardly expect an airfield to function properly in war when it was within range of guns of any battleships covering the invasion force.
Did you, in your duties, have much to do with the local RAF?
I met them. Again, this is a long time ago. It's 50 years ago, and I can't remember thing, but an awful lot of any personal friends in it. They were, as far as I remember, they were basically Australian RAF or RAAF. But they had Hudson's bombers. And they did. I did go up on several occasions to recce the country from the air, which was saved me an awful lot of time and trouble. But I can't recall any very, very close amalgamation with them.
Did the local Air Force inspire you with confidence?
I think the Air Force was all right. I think it was the situation of Cote d'Ivoire Airfield. We were also building at the same time two other airfields, one at Pasiopute, which was further down the coast, and another one was at Machang, roughly in the middle of Cote d'Ivoire. But there again, you see, it was also lackadaisical. There wasn't any pressure to get these airfields finished. Had they got Machang finished straight away, they could have moved Cote d'Ivoire Airfield in there, and the place could operate.
Were they finished in time?
No, they weren't. Another one of my hypes, in retrospect, we tried to get the barbed wire on the beaches laid by local labour. We were told there wasn't enough money for this. Now, if this had all been the beach defences under military supervision had been laid by local labour, you could have then allowed the battalions who were defending those at least a bit of time in the jungle where they'd learn a bit of jungle warfare. But as far as I could see, Malaya Command didn't think that the Japanese were going to leave the roads or the railways.
So who laid the wire in the end?
The sepoy. British troops. Or the Indian troops, rather.
How did they react to doing that?
Oh, well, they didn't mind doing it, but I mean, it was a bloody waste of time, wasn't it? Well, Billy Keyes, he had... once again, remember, I was very junior. He was in always banging his head against the brick wall of the troops actually doing things that they really weren't meant to do. And they weren't pioneer corps.
Did you have any pioneers?
No, not that I can remember.
Were there many Japanese civilians in your area, in Kelantan?
There were quite a few. There was a Japanese hairdresser, but there was a Japanese hairdresser in every town in Malaya. They also had something to do in the Tumpat, which was the port, small port, between Siam and Kelantan. They had a lot of iron ore, which they were still allowed to dig out. And the main big place, of course, was at Dungun, which was, I think, just north of Kuantan, where, of course, they eventually landed as well.
So they hadn't been interned?
No. No.
Was there
they when the war started, of course, they went. But there were... The whole thing was so amateurish, looking back.
Were any restrictions put on local Japanese before?
I can't remember. I can't remember if there were any restrictions were put on them by the civilians. I don't think so.
Did you use this Japanese hairdresser yourself?
I tried to convince him that there was more than one brigade by leaving a false map in his hairdressing, which showed, instead of the companies on in various places, battalions. In fact, upping the strength. But he wasn't prepared to take that. I can remember him coming out and said, "Saab, you've left your map behind." They knew it all. They'd been there a long time.
So you were definitely suspicious of them?
Oh, yes. I think any Japanese around the area was...
Did you do any more attempts at planting false information for the local Japanese?
No, I didn't do any more. I rarely would have thought that came under the role of the police, but... There again, it was, although the Malayan police were very good, I thought. I did one other thing, which I did two things, and this all both rarely come together. I was taken down to Singapore in about August of 1941. I went down to Singapore because they wanted to see, headquarters wanted to question me about the work I was doing. And I think it got through that there was a rather odd officer who used to spend his leaves in the jungle. And they wanted to interview me, intelligence in Singapore. And there I gained the impression that they were absolutely sure that the Japanese, one, they weren't quite sure if they were coming, and two, if they did come, they certainly wouldn't take to the jungle. And I tried to explain to them in my very limited military knowledge that if you took up a position covering a road, in my opinion, and it turned out to be right, the Japanese would approach your position, find out where it was, and merely enfilade it. In which case you had got to have defence in depth so that as they enfiladed the first lot, they were met by a second lot, and that they would be quite prepared to use tracks in the jungle, which they did, because they'd been trained to this.
What success did you have in persuading them?
I don't think they listened very much to a captain of 22. I did meet down there Colonel Gavin, who was in the process of forming or training left behind parties. I forget the actual proper name of the formation. It's in many books, but Colonel Gavin was he was interested. In actual fact, he asked me if I would like to become part of the setup, and I said no, I'd rather go back to Kelantan. I didn't like Singapore very much. And the other person I met, of course, who was of great fame afterwards, was John Daly. Now, John Daly was a policeman in charge of the keeping an eye, shall we say, naively, keeping an eye on the Chinese communists. And he formed Dal Force, which was the Chinese communist resistance parties who fought in the jungle against the Japanese with Spencer Chapman, or Spencer Chapman attached himself to. And of course, who were the core of the Chinese fighting British in the emergency of Malaya, 48 to 60. He was a very nice man, very kind man. I spent my 22nd birthday with him.
Was this just one meeting you had with him?
Oh, I spent my 3 or 4 days in his house, because he was very keen in charge. I think he had something to do with the Malayan police boxing. And he heard that I'd been a bit of a boxer, and he got me down there to train the Malayan police boxing side.
How long did you spend with Gavin?
I think I must have spent about 3 or 4 days with him when I was down in Singapore. but he was also quite interested in my thoughts. But I think on the whole that I was treated as a rather eccentric young officer who had got a bee in his bonnet about the jungle.
Even by Gavin?
No, not by Gavin. I think he realised that this was going to happen. But you see, his hands were tied. Higher command said, no, we can't help you in this. We don't see any need for this. I think it got underway. I think Spencer Chapman got out there in September, September 41. Well, good God, the bloody Japanese landed in 2 months' time.
Now, can we go on to the actual landing, and can you take me through in detail what are your own personal memories of it, step by step, please?
Yeah. Five days, we got information from the Catalina flying boats that operated out of Singapore up the Gulf of Siam that something was happening. And then they reported that this fleet was sailing south from in the Gulf of Siam, Japanese. We went to battle stations. After a couple of days, and on the night of the 7th, 8th, and I can't remember, it's in the book, but in various books, but I can't remember if I think it was about 2 minutes after midnight. Brian North, who commanded the Dogra companies on Sabak and Bacho Beach, where the Japanese landed, reported that there were ships off the beach. Um, And I said, well, if the ship... I was officer on duty at brigade headquarters, and I said to him, well, if the ship's off the beach, you better engage them. And the first shot that was fired was from an obsolete 25-pounder gun, which was on the beach, which had been used in various ceremonial... It was a ceremonial gun taken off some forecourt. Shows you what our artillery was. I then went up and woke up Billy Key and said, they've arrived, sir. I've told... Brown's phoned up and I've told him to open fire. And Billy got out of bed and said, trust you to start a bloody war, Mike. And then from then on we...
So he was quite calm about it.
Oh, yes. He was absolutely sure that this was going to happen. And after all, we did have 3 or 5 days' notice. I've often wondered why that notice wasn't passed to Pearl Harbor. Because Malaya Command knew about it. After all, one of the Catalina flying boats didn't return. Was shot down by the... Must have been shot down by the fleet. I do know that the RAF bombed... I think there were 3 transports off the beach. Now, I'm talking just from my own memories. I'm not... looking back on any books or anything at all, and so if there were 5 ships off the Padang and Sabah Beach, all right, there were 5. As far as I was concerned, that one was bombed by the RAF, but within the next day, dawn appeared. Cote d'Ivoire airfield was bombed and shot out of existence by the Japs. Who? I'd like to go back.
Yes, please.
If I might.